The following Dharma talk was recorded in July 2014 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of three recordings from the retreat called Cultivating Insight with an Open Heart, taught by Phil Jones. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Philip Jones has practiced meditation since 1987 and has been teaching insight meditation since 1996. He has studied with teachers from Spirit Rock and the Insight Meditation Society and graduated from the first Community Dharma Leader Program in 2000. More info can be found at www.silentmindopenheart.org.
So how many of you began to practice meditation or maybe even came to this retreat because you were completely happy with the way your life has been going? I was just going to say, you know, if there was anyone who did, then you can leave. You don't need to be here. Now, we often come to meditation or to spiritual practice because we experience some kind of unsatisfactoriness with our lives. For some, it may just be, you know, a little bit of dissatisfaction or uneasiness. For others, there may be a significant amount of stress. And for some people, actually quite a bit of intense suffering. So there's this whole range. And some of us may come because of all of those reasons at different times in our lives. Whatever the degree of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness or suffering, has brought us to this practice, we're looking for some different way to live with our lives as they are, to find a way to be satisfied with our lives, to live with more happiness and more contentment. Part of the promise of the early Buddhist teachings is that we're told that if we develop some skills and if we let go of some behaviors and thought patterns, then we can indeed live with more satisfaction and more happiness in our lives. So part of what I hope to emphasize this weekend is the development of some of these skills and some of these behaviors for us to let go of. I hope we'll be able to explore this not only intellectually, but also experientially as we do our own practice. And as we practice together. So during the retreat, I'll be offering some talks, some instructions. We'll be doing sitting and walking. We'll be doing a little eating meditation before lunch tomorrow. Maybe a little resting, which can be a very important part of retreat practice as well. And there will be time, as John mentioned, for what I like to call practice consultations. Time when you can come in and talk about what's going on in your practice. So it's a little different emphasis than the word interview. It's more of a consultative process. We talk together about how things are going, what's going on. And on this particular retreat, we'll be doing that in groups, which have the limitation that they're not quite as private. So maybe it feels a little more uncomfortable to talk about certain parts of practice, but they have the benefit that we get to learn from each other. So I hope that, first I hope that you'll take advantage of the practice consultations for yourselves, but also that you'll be willing to ask your questions out of a spirit of generosity both to yourself and to the other participants, because it will give them the chance to learn from your experience as well. So I want to build the talk tonight around two sutta selections. Two selections from the Buddha's discourses. The first is recorded as having been given by one of the Buddha's chief disciples, Sariputta, or in the Sanskrit, which you may have be more familiar with, Shariputta. This is from the Mahagosinga Sutta, the Greater Discourse in Gosinga, which was the location where this teaching was given. It's from the Middle Length Discourses, number 32. And it begins, or this part of it begins, a bhikkhu. A bhikkhu is a Pali word which is typically translated as monk. But I've been told by reliable sources that particularly on retreat, we can take the term bhikkhu to refer to all of us who are practicing. So as you hear this word, bhikkhu, just take it to mean talking about yourself or other people who are practicing here. A bhikkhu wields mastery over his mind. He does not let the mind wield mastery over him. In the morning, she abides in whatever abiding or attainment she wants to abide in during the morning. At midday, he abides in whatever abiding or attainment he wants to abide in at midday. In the evening, she abides in whatever abiding or attainment she wants to abide in during the evening. So we have this idea that this training we're doing can lead us to have this kind of mastery over our own minds, so that when it's useful to have a concentrated mind, we're able to easily concentrate our minds. When it's useful to have a spacious mind, it's easy to establish a spacious mind. When it's appropriate to have a mind filled with goodwill, no matter what the circumstances are, we're able to establish goodwill in our minds and in our hearts. And so forth, and so on. This may sound like an unreachable level of mastery. But most of you have been practicing for a while, for some time, You've been working with mindfulness. And I'd encourage you to just reflect on the progress you've made in being able to bring mindfulness to your life experiences. There was probably a time when you thought that level that you now have just wasn't conceivable. But it's happened because you've practiced diligently with it. You've developed the skill for yourself of bringing mindfulness to your experience. So in the same way, with diligent practice, we can develop these other skills for ourselves as well. One of the reasons that this level of mastery is possible is because the Buddha understood that our path of practice is a gradual one. And so I'd like to spend the remainder of this talk speaking about what the Buddha called the gradual training. I'd like to do this within the context of another one of the Buddha's teachings, which is the simile of the goldsmith. This is found in the numerical discourses, the Book of Threes, number 101. So the section I want to begin with reads, "There are gross defilements of gold, soil, grit, and gravel. Now the soil remover first pours the gold into a trough and washes and rinses and cleans it. So too, when a bhikkhu is devoted to the higher mind, there are in him gross defilements, bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them." In another discourse on the gradual training, in the middle-length discourses, number 27, the Buddha speaks of the first three steps in the gradual training as involving, first of all, having the good fortune to hear the Buddha's teachings or to hear about the practice. It's actually very rare for that to happen. So we're all very fortunate to in some way have had some exposure to that. And then after hearing about it, having some level of faith or confidence in what we heard, that we're willing to try it out for ourselves to see if it really works. And then the third level that the Buddha talks about in the gradual training is to begin to try it out in terms of developing our own ethical lives, our own virtue. One version of this is in terms of what are called the five precepts. I'd like to read over these as just a reminder for all of us. This is just one version of the precepts. I undertake the training of refraining from taking the life of any living being and developing the quality of goodwill towards all beings. I undertake the training of refraining from taking what has not been given and developing the quality of generosity. I undertake the training of not engaging in sexual misconduct or not engaging in any intentional sexual activities while on retreat, and respecting the commitments and boundaries of my own and other committed relationships. I undertake the training of not engaging in false or harmful speech, and training in speaking what is true, timely, and beneficial. And I undertake the training of not using intoxicating drink or drugs that lead to heedlessness, while understanding that it is permissible to use medications as prescribed for a health condition. Now, when you registered for this retreat, you may recall that you were asked to make a commitment to follow the precepts while you were on the retreat. There's two reasons that we asked you to do this. The first is that it helps to create a container of interpersonal safety for all of us. And because of that, it allows us then to relax and turn inward more easily. And second, when our ethics or virtue is strong, and once again, we're able to relax, we can do so because we trust our own intentions. We know we can trust our own heart. And it turns out that this relaxation, the ease, the sense of gladness that comes from that trust in our own hearts, our own intentions, is a condition for the development of a concentrated mind, which, of course, is a necessary part of what we need to develop in order to see what's true in our own minds and our own hearts. Although working with virtue is really one of the first things that we do in the gradual training, I have to say that it's really part of the practice from the beginning through the end. As we move further in the practice, and the things we begin to pay attention to grow more and more subtle, then the questions of ethics that we pay attention to can also become more subtle. And so they feed on that way and support each other until we come to the end. So the simile of the goldsmith continues. When the gross defilements have been removed and eliminated, there still remain middle-sized defilements in the gold, fine grit and coarse sand. The soil remover washes, rinses, and cleans it again. Similarly, there remain in the practitioner middling defilements, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. So one way that we can understand this part of the training is that it refers to removing from our minds, at least temporarily, what are often called the five hindrances. This is a big part of our practice. Each time we sit down to meditate, we have to deal with the five hindrances. And actually, they're part of our practice even when we're not formally meditating. They're also a big part of our practice over the long arc of practice. We work with these qualities consistently, recognizing them, abandoning them, replacing them with more skillful or wholesome qualities, until we attain one or more of the stages of awakening where they're permanently abandoned. So for most of us, they're with us for quite a while. The first of the hindrances is the tendency to grasp or go after, to have greed for sensory experiences, pleasant experiences that arise at each of the sense doors, visual sights, sounds, pleasant odors, tastes, bodily sensations, and pleasant thoughts that arise in the mind. The tendency to pursue these pleasant experiences is a really pretty basic part of what it is to be a human being. It's so basic that we may think that it's really not something that we can get mastery over. Yet if we reflect on it for just a minute, growing up as children and going to school, a lot of what the training was about was learning to move our attention from things that maybe we found pleasant to other things that we needed to pay attention to, or were told we needed to pay attention to. So we do have the skill, we do have some basis in learning to move attention from pleasant sense experiences to something else that we have an intention to give our attention to. The second of the hindrances that we need to temporarily suppress and eventually eliminate is the tendency towards ill will, aversion, fear, and hatred. Not only does this mean letting go of anger, it also means recognizing and letting go of the momentary impulse or wish to not experience something that's unpleasant. It also means developing the quality of goodwill towards others, towards ourselves, even towards our momentary experiences, without getting entangled with them. It's a simple courage and determination to be present for each moment of our lives, even if this one happens to be unpleasant. A practice that we can do both on the cushion but especially during our daily lives, that is a real helpful way of working with these first two hindrances, is the practice of guarding the sense doors. It involves bringing mindful attention to each of our sense doors, kind of in a relaxed but global kind of way, kind of a floating attention, noticing what's arising at our different sense doors in any particular moment, and noticing when the tendency to grab onto or to push away occurs. Rather than getting entangled in those moments with whatever the sense experience is, just watching that impulse to grab or to push away, watching it fall away, and then allowing the next thing to arise, whatever it is. I'll talk about this a little more tomorrow morning. The third of the hindrances is a tendency to fall into what is sometimes called sloth and torpor, sleepiness and sluggishness, or dullness. This can be particularly challenging on the first day or so of a retreat. We're on a short retreat, so we may have a lot of this to deal with. It especially happens on the first day because we often come to retreat tired, overstimulated, and sleep deprived. And so we sit down, we start getting quiet, we start getting relaxed, and the body and mind take that as a sign that it's time to fall asleep. It's understandable. So we have a balancing act that we need to work with. On the one hand, establishing a certain amount of relaxation is necessary to do this practice. But we need to balance that with bringing enough energy to stay awake. Literally, to stay awake for what's happening right here, right now. If you do find yourself falling asleep on the cushion, when you wake up, don't beat yourself up about it. Don't get all upset or judgmental with yourself. This happened because of conditions. Just try to bring more energy to it. One way of bringing more energy is by being curious. See if you can notice when that impulse of sleepiness begins to arise. Notice what it feels like. Notice if there's anything pleasant about it. If there's something that kind of pulls you into it. See what sleepiness is like for you. Another way of working with it is, and to bring energy, is to open your eyes. Not really trying to look at anything in particular, but just opening your eyes enough to let light energy in. That sometimes is enough stimulation to help you stay awake. And one last thing I want to mention at this point is the practice of, if you find yourself being very drowsy or falling asleep, take a very deep breath quietly. Hold it as long as you can, and then hold it a little bit longer, and then quietly exhale as deeply as you can, and take another deep breath and hold it. And do this about 3 times. And see if that doesn't bring more energy up for you and help you to stay more awake. And then during walking meditation, you might find it helpful to take a brisk walk rather than trying to move very, very slowly. Although sleepiness and sluggishness is often an indication, at least in the first few days of a retreat, that we're tired, it can also be an indication that there's something that's trying to come into awareness that we're not quite willing to be awake to. And so we keep falling asleep to it instead. So, you know, if you find yourself getting sleepy and you've looked at it and, you know, you don't really seem to be tired, then pose a question for yourself. Is there something trying to come into awareness? Can I be with it? Just kind of pose the question and just kind of hold it in a loose kind of way, and then go back to your practice, working with your meditation object, but just to see if anything comes up. It may not. While sleepiness and sluggishness is often a problem of not enough energy, the next hindrance, restlessness and worry, or physical and mental agitation, is an expression, usually, of too much energy. You find it hard to sit still. It may feel like you have ants running under your skin, or there's prickly sensations all over, or you just have these itches, you know? You just have this need to move. Or you may find that your mind just keeps jumping from thing to thing to thing to thing to thing. Or you're caught in some kind of obsessive worry that, you know, it just keeps coming up again and again. Maybe, well, you know, if I tweak it this way or if I do that, then everything will be okay. And you think, oh, okay, well, if I do it this way, it'll be fine. That takes care of it. I don't need to think about this anymore. And then the next thing you know, there it is again. You're thinking about it. Oh, okay, well, maybe if I did it this way this time, you know, that would take care of it. It just keeps coming up again and again and again. There's a lot of energy there. So this might be a time when maybe spending some extra time doing walking meditation would be helpful. It might be helpful to do some brisk walking meditation to burn up a little bit of energy. And just as with sleepiness, restlessness can arise because there's something that's trying to come up into awareness that is uncomfortable to see. And the discomfort's there, and so we start reacting to the discomfort, and that keeps us then from ever seeing what it is that's trying to arise. So one of the practices that it's useful to do with restlessness and worry is to see if we can just kind of make a resolve for ourselves. I'm just going to be with this. I'm just going to sit through this. It doesn't matter how much restlessness there is. I'm just going to sit here. And it's not easy, because restlessness is unpleasant, whether it's physical or mental. So it requires courage to do this, and it requires determination to do it. But if we can, what often happens, if it's not just excess energy, is that whatever that thought is, does eventually come into awareness. We see it. And then it's like the body and the mind relax. Even if it's something that's not especially pleasant to see, there's a relaxation because we've finally been able to be with this part of our lives, this truth of our lives. The fifth of the hindrances is the quality of doubt. In terms of the practice, it's primarily doubt about your own practice, doubt about the teachings. Is this the right teaching? Or what does this teaching mean? Or I don't understand what this teaching means. Or doubt about the teacher. This person's okay, but really this person's better. You know, the next time there's a retreat on schedule with this person, I'm going to go practice with them. And, you know, and so here you are, you're practicing and your mind is spinning off to some next time in the future when you're going to practice, rather than taking advantage of practicing right now when you have the opportunity to do so. This quality of doubt can also sometimes get hooked up with that kind of obsessive quality that comes with restlessness. So that in this sense, doubting ourselves, not simply about the practice, but about other aspects of our lives as well. Doubt is, of all of these, is the most corrosive of the hindrances, because doubt undercuts our ability to do the practice at all. So if you notice doubt arising, and that's the important thing to do, is to notice that this is doubt, or if you just find yourself stuck, talk to a teacher or someone who's more experienced in the practice than you are, who you trust, and talk about what's going on and see if they can give you some guidance, give you some perspective that helps to clarify things or gives you a broader perspective on what might be going on. In order to work with these hindrances, we need to recognize that they're here, which is why I'm talking about them. And not only recognizing that they're present, but meeting them with a quality of mindfulness. Not judging that they're present, simply recognizing this is what's present right now. Watching it rise and fall. And having a certain amount of concentration to be able to see that this is what's present. And the kind of wondrous thing is that the more we recognize when the hindrances are present and let go of them, the stronger our concentration gets. And the stronger our concentration gets, the more the hindrances are temporarily suppressed so they don't bother us as much. And as they're suppressed, our mindfulness and our concentration get stronger. And so it just continues to build in that way. So the simile goes on. When that middling defilement has been removed and eliminated, there still remain subtle defilements in the gold, fine sand and black dust. So the soil remover washes, rinses, and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, only grains of gold remain. In a similar way, there remain in the practitioner subtle defilements, thoughts about his relations, thoughts about her country, thoughts about his reputation. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. So by this point in our practice, we've actually made a lot of progress. We've developed our virtue, which has contributed to inner and outer harmony, and has also been training our minds. We've learned to recognize and work with the five hindrances to some degree. And part of the practice is not only to recognize when unwholesome qualities are present, but to recognize when wholesome ones are as well. So it's important for us to recognize that we have actually made a lot of progress in our practice, even as we continue to work with the things that continue to distract us, that continue to lead us to unsatisfactoriness and suffering. So don't forget to give yourself credit for what you've accomplished. That's one of the very beneficial reflections that we're supposed to do as part of this practice. This section of the simile is pointing toward another area that's a major stumbling block for us as we try to calm and focus our minds. It's all the thoughts that arise that have to do with I, me, and my stuff. Mine. Within Buddhist psychology, all of these fall into the category that's called conceit. It means a little more than what conceit means typically in the English language. At one level, it has to do with getting caught in comparing, I'm better than you are, which is the way we typically think about it in our language. This manifests in a lot of ways, one of which is, I'm a better meditator than that person is. I can do X and they clearly can't. So that's a quality of conceit. Another aspect of conceit is, I'm worse than you are. I'm not as good as you are. So, within the context of this practice, you're so much better at this than I am. You're such a good meditator. Man, you sit there without moving. You must really, really be deep, and I'm sitting over here, and, you know, my mind's just spinning away. I'm just no good at this, but you're really terrific. You must be, you know, at least partially enlightened at this point. This is a form of conceit. And then the third form of conceit is, you're the same as I am, which doesn't sound like conceit to our Western ears, maybe, but it's another way of comparing. You and I are the same. Underlying each of these forms of comparison is a more basic aspect of conceit. The sense or the belief that there's actually an I here who is having this experience and can therefore be compared to the you out there who's better than or worse than or the same as. So when we look at our minds, we can often find that almost all of our thoughts have something to do with I, me, or mine. I once had the meditation instruction to pay attention and count how many thoughts in a period of meditation involved this. And it was, I lost count. I mean, but it was almost every one of them. So while the hindrances of sense desire and aversion often have a lot to do with our five physical sense doors and the pleasant and unpleasant things that arise at those doors, these subtler defilements really have to do with the sixth sense door, with our minds, with the tendency to cognize or know things or conceptualize things. And in order to get our minds to focus or to settle down, there has to be an intention, a willingness to let go of these self-centric thoughts as well. At least for a while. At least while we're meditating. And once again, we're able to let go through the application, through the development of the skills of mindfulness and concentration. Seeing clearly, oh, this is what's happening here. Watching it rise and fall rather than getting tangled up with it. And in terms of concentration, training ourselves in focusing on the object of our meditation and letting these other thoughts of I, me, and mine, just letting them go. Just coming back again and again to the object and letting I, me, and mine go. Next, the sutta says, the goldsmith, division of labor here, I guess, between the washer and the goldsmith. The goldsmith now pours the gold into a melting pot and fans it, melts it, and smelts it. But even when this has been done, the gold is not yet settled and the dross has not yet been entirely removed. The gold is not yet malleable, wieldy, and luminous, but still brittle and not properly fit for work. Similarly, there remain thoughts in the practitioner's mind connected with the Dhamma. Thoughts that concentration that is established is not peaceful and sublime, not gained by full tranquilization, not attained to unification. So that concentration is still involving a lot of effort. It's reined in and checked by forcefully suppressing the defilements. So this section, this level of the gradual training, seems to be referring to our practice of mindfulness and concentration up to the level of what is sometimes called access concentration. Our concentration is actually fairly strong. We may be able to stay with our meditation object for a number of moments at a time. Things may seem pretty clear to us, but we're still pretty easily distracted. For most of us, this is a level of concentration that we might be able to reach on this weekend retreat. We might be able to reach this during our daily practice on those days when we're really pretty settled. It depends on us being fairly relaxed and alert and able to let go again and again while being very vigilant with our mindfulness. At this level of concentration, we begin to see pretty regularly the three characteristics in any moment of experience. We begin to see how things are constantly changing, how they're impermanent. We begin to see that the things that arise into experience are ultimately not really satisfactory. They may temporarily be pleasant, but that always changes. And then there's the unpleasant to deal with once again. And we begin to see that these things that arise because of certain conditions. And when those conditions change, something else comes into the mind. So in other words, everything, just about everything, that comes into mind is conditional. Or the word that's often used is not self. There is no self in what I'm experiencing, including within what happens in this body and mind. Not self in a psychological sense, which is something different from what's being talked about here. This is a kind of an enduring entity. And of course, we're seeing that everything's changing and that it arises and passes due to conditions. So how could there be an enduring entity here? We're still not quite at the point of mastery. There's one last part to the gradual training. But as the goldsmith continues to fan, melt, and smelt the gold, a time comes when the gold is settled and the dross has been entirely removed, so that the gold becomes malleable, wieldy, and luminous, pliant and properly fit for work. Then whatever kind of ornament the goldsmith wishes to make from it, he can achieve his purpose. In the same way, there comes a time when one's mind becomes internally steady, composed, unified, and concentrated. That concentration is peaceful and sublime, gained by full tranquilization, attained to unification. It is not reined in and checked by forcefully suppressing the defilements. Then there being a suitable basis, this level of concentration, one is capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge towards which one might incline one's mind. This is the point where we begin to have the skill, the mastery, that Sariputta is talking about. There are six, it's said there are six states of knowledge that typically are likely to arise with this level of mastery. The first five have to do with mental or psychic powers that can be developed. They're all conditioned things, and they can have some value, but they don't have liberating effects for us. It's the sixth one that's really important. It's at this level that we easily see the three characteristics in everything. We no longer just see things arising and passing, but we see that change is really all that there is. We begin to have a deeply experiential understanding of the Four Noble Truths. First, as we've noted earlier, that all conditioned things are ultimately not satisfying. Second, that we experience unsatisfactoriness because we crave things and attempt to cling to them, even though they're not ultimately satisfactory. Third, that when we deeply see things as they are, we stop craving and clinging. And so there is peace and a subtle happiness. And fourth, we realize experientially that there is indeed a path of practice, a path that we've been traveling, the Noble Eightfold Path, the path of this gradual training, and that it's a path that will lead to our own realization of peace and happiness. So whether you came to get a little bit calmer, or because you really aspire to be free from greed, hatred, and delusion, that is, awakening to your life as it is, this is the path that we're on and the practice that we're involved with this weekend.